This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Powered by U Mobile, Malaysia's number one 5G network.
BFM 89.9, I'm Philip C. and this is The Breakfast Grill. Today is the United Nations English Language Day, and the day aims to promote the importance of English language, culture diversity and multilingualism. Today we're going to have a panel conversation with two really esteemed guests. In the studio today we have with us Dr. Lee Soo Kim. She's an author and former associate professor at the English Language Studies at University Kebangsaan, Malaysia. And we also have associate professor Dr. Ramesh Nair, associate professor at the Academy of Language Studies at University Technology Mara, and immediate past president of the Malaysian English Language Teachers Association. Welcome to the grill.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Lee, can I just start with you first? You know, this perception that proficiency and application of English language in Malaysia has been declining and deteriorating. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I do. It has definitely declined. In the past, because many of the schools used the English medium. But in 1970, there was this policy where you had to phase out English, and Bahasa Malaysia became the medium of instruction. And that led, in a way, to a gradual decline. It's okay to have bilingualism and multilingualism policies, but I think what happened was there were too many flip-flop decisions. The standards definitely just went down. And today, you come across work and assignments that are full of errors and sometimes even bordering on gibberish.
Yeah, you hear so much complaints from employers about the deterioration in quality of English. And interesting, you hark it back to the 1970s, right? What policies, you know, since then, did we try to address it and those did not work? Dr. Ramesh?
Well, you know, when we trace development of language policy, national language policy, we obviously need to compare practices or other policies which were in place in the past to what is the present. So as Soo Kim has pointed out, our education system is rooted in the colonial past. English was the medium of instruction, at least in our secondary schools and universities, until the 1970s, when we gradually began to shift to the Malay language as our medium of instruction. So obviously, when we talk about declining standards, we're comparing the proficiency of our students today to those who, you know, studied when English was the medium of instruction before the 1970s. In comparison, obviously, it would appear that our proficiency, or rather students' proficiency in English, has been on the decline. But having said that, I think what's evident today is that the education system appears not to be meeting the expectations of lawyers as well as, you know, higher learning institutions which are receiving our students, our school leavers. Mm.
And so, Kim, when you think about the deterioration and decline of our proficiency, right, is it even and applied across the country, or do you see certain pockets where the level is still held pretty well, but some parts of the nation at certain income levels or locations where it's deteriorated much faster?
Yeah, I think so. I think in the urban areas, in the more privileged schools, the standard of English is still fine. But I think in the rural areas where to many students, English doesn't seem very relevant to them, they can't quite figure out why they need this language. So I think English isn't that good over in the rural areas as compared to those in the schools in the urban areas.
Which then breaks the question, right, Ramesh, whether or not this uneven decline has resulted in a divergence, right, of even greater income inequality in Malaysia, right? Do you see that clear correlation and translation taking place there?
I would say that the relationship between English language proficiency and income inequality in Malaysia can be seen as multifaceted. Children from more affluent communities, you know, as Soo Kim has pointed out, depending on where you find yourself in the country, you have students who have the option to access quality education. For example, in many international schools which have mushroomed around the country, especially here in the Klang Valley, and then you also have students in public schools come with access to a dual language program as compared to other students who do not have that same access. So all this has contributed to imbalances. And I think, you know, if resources resources for English language education are unequally distributed, whether it's across regions or, you know, across socioeconomic groups, can perpetuate economic, or income inequality by limiting opportunities for those with lower proficiency.
Yeah, I think also the social, the cultural context is also quite important, because in rural areas or even in towns, sometimes within localized contexts, there is this feeling that if you use English, if you speak English, you are trying to show off, you're trying to be elitist, you are sombong, you cakap orang putih. So I think when we teach English, we have to be very aware as well, not just of teaching materials, teaching techniques, teachers, but as well the social cultural context. And we have to be sensitive to this. This was my research in my doctoral dissertation. My Malay rural students, my participants in the research study, shared that when they spoke English and they were good English speakers, they were frowned upon. They were sort of like ostracized because they were using English. And this was also shared from a Chinese student. So I think that also has to be taken into account. So when we teach English, we have to be very aware of this, that, you know, the social cultural context may not be so friendly.
I find it fascinating that there's a stigma in learning English. I would have assumed that the reason why people don't learn English is that, oh, because there's limited resources, that I need to focus on Bahasa as a bigger priority. But you point out to a bigger issue, that actually learning a language like English language is actually a potential stigma, a negative for you.
Yeah, I thought that was quite fascinating, because not just the Malay participants in my research study, even the Chinese students, you know, because when they mix with students who came from the Chinese medium schools at university level, this participant shared with me that she was ostracized. They looked at her, oh, you're not very Chinese. How come you can't speak Mandarin? How come you're so matsale? And even the Tamil participant in my study shared that same thing, that she was sort I think she went to church and all the Tamil speaking, they sort of like frowned at her because she could not speak Tamil. So I thought that was quite fascinating.
Very interesting. Quite sad, actually, to see this kind of cultural context coming in. And I guess, you know, Ramesh, when you think about today's day and age where you have a whole mix of technology and globalization, do you think that aids or even disables the effort to try to teach the language in these hard-to-reach areas then?
Well, I think we would expect technology to support and facilitate language education in ways that, you know, access that we didn't have in the past. These are access that we have now. And of course, I think looking back at the time of the pandemic when schools were shut down and students had to go online to receive education, we now know that learning loss occurred during that time. At least that is what the ministry reports. And so based on that, we know that although we would like to believe there is access to technology and technology supports language learning, we really need the infrastructure in place for us to take advantage of technology. Based on reports, you know, in mainstream media, if you remember during the pandemic, we had, you know, reports of students having to climb up trees to gain access to Wi-Fi access. So yes, if provided the right infrastructure and provided the right training for teachers, technology is something we can certainly leverage on supporting us in teaching language.
And that's why it's so important to couple it well with, as you say, Ramesh, the infrastructure with the teaching capacity. I presume we can assume then, or am I making the wrong hypothesis, that our education system isn't really geared up to support that whole integration of technology with infrastructure and capacity building by the teachers then?
No, if you read about policies which have been in place, you could trace efforts to equip our schools with technology back in the 1990s. There were already programs in place. Unfortunately, policies have not translated completely into successful outcomes. You still find schools void of, you know, access to basic technology facilities. So you have teachers who are struggling in the classrooms. You know, they have ideas, they have plans, you know, they've been trained to make use of technology in the classroom. But depending on where they find themselves, they're not able to, translate that into action.
I think
that's frustrating for teachers.
I think teachers also need a lot more of support, because there's so much emphasis on paperwork now. I hear from friends that they want to retire because there's so much paperwork, there's so much obsession with quantification, and there's an excessive preoccupation with examinations. And I think, as I'm sure Dr. Ramesh will agree, examinations sort of drive rote learning. So perhaps, language policy should also take that into consideration. Teachers need more support. Maybe schools could employ more administrators to take over the the paperwork for the teachers, because teachers should actually just be doing teaching, not doing paperwork.
Which then begs the question that if we see so much struggle in the education system, and I do wonder that technology is such a wonderful time to learn a language, because you can mix the visual, the videos, and to a certain extent TikTok. Even blurs the understanding of language, you know, because you're mixing everything and it's so beautiful. I wonder if you're seeing evidence that actually students are taking things in their own hand and learning it themselves. But that's a risk, right, when you don't have this structured form of teaching and instruction of a language? Or is that not really a problem?
All right. So, yes, there is now more opportunities than ever before for individuals to pick up languages independently, even without access to formal education. You hear of, you probably know of nephews and nieces in your circle who are picking up languages like Japanese or Korean simply by watching, shows which are available on YouTube and, even picking up writing these languages. So yes, there is that opportunity, but you can't play down the importance of formal language, access to formal language education that is necessary, especially in the context of teaching English here in Malaysia. As Su Kim had pointed out just now, there are students in some parts of the country who don't even have the motivation to learn the language. Mm-hmm. And so it falls on a formal education system to provide that access. Because, for a lot of children, learning, telling them that you need English for your future is not enough, because the future is a distant future for most children. Mm. They want to see the relevance of what they're learning to their immediate surrounding. Mm. And that environment may not necessarily be there for all students.
Yeah, I remember when I was sent to a very rural school in Kelantan, Pasir Putih, what was important was not to just tell the students or talk down to them and tell them, you need English because it's important. It's going to be, it is a global lingua franca. They don't understand it. They don't see why it's relevant. So what I did was I used a lot of creativity. I brought a guitar to the classroom. I used music, comedy skits. I used drama, sketches. I got them to form a choir and sing songs. So at the end of it, they really enjoyed it. They looked forward to the class. Even though they had very minimal English, but they just absolutely loved the subject. And I think that's very important for young children, to make it very interesting, to make it fun and enjoyable, rather than teach them in a very top-down kind of teacher-centered approach. That's so important, to build in internal motivation for them, intrinsic motivation, rather than tell them that you need this in the future, because to them in the rural areas they just don't care.
They don't care about it what the future looks like in 10 years for them, right? You need the incentives that are a bit more shorter term to pull them in to learn the language.
Yeah, and today, as you said just now, Philip, there's so much out there: technology, TikTok videos, social media, Facebook. There's so much you can use to get them interested, to get them seem very real to them, relevant to them.
I wonder, when we go ahead and try and motivate this generation to learn language, it also is to motivate their parents as well, also, right, to embrace it, isn't it? Because if you need to drive shorter term incentives about why it's so valuable to learn the language in your community now, you do need to get the broader community engaged on this, right? Not just the students, right?
So I think, again, coming back to what I said, it's this thing about identity and language. Maybe in the rural areas, you seem to think that if you learn English, you are subtracting from your own identity. That if you learn another language, for example, English, that is the language of the Western world or the language of the colonizers. And you know that in Malay, it's very much linked to your identity. So does that mean that you're subtracting from your identity? So I think, subtractive bilingualism has been disproved. Research has disproved that. It has somehow, you've got to get a message across to them that it doesn't affect your identity. It doesn't make you lose out anyway, it only helps you to gain, So I think that's quite important.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and return after these messages in conjunction with United Nations English Language Day. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile, Malaysia's number one 5G network.
Welcome back. On The Grill, we have a panel with us in conjunction with English Language Day with Associate Professor Dr. Ramesh Nair and Dr. Lee Soo Kim. Now, World English Language Day is celebrated annually on the April 23rd to mark the birth and death anniversary of William Shakespeare. And perhaps that's the biggest challenge, isn't it? We don't want to claim English language as our own due to its context being set in 16th century England. Do you agree with that, Soo Kim?
Yes. we don't want to claim it, but we should be proficient in it. Well, English, as you said, comes from motherland England, but English is used over a wide, well, many, many countries in the world. So it is just inevitable that because it is used in vastly different cultural contexts, it will somehow evolve and sort of mutate. So you'll find that it's quite interesting. In all parts of the world, you have different varieties of English. You've got, like, for example, Spanglish.
Yes.
In Spain. We've got Singlish, Singapore, Manglish, Malaysian English, Japlish, Japanese English, Taglish, Tagalog English, English, Indian English, Ponglish, Poland English. Yeah, so it's fascinating to see how it has all evolved and developed into very different varieties.
You're a big proponent about encouraging the evolution, isn't it? About putting the cultural context into the English language and making it our own and claiming it our own, hence Manglish.
Yes. So what is important, and I like to stress this, is that when you want to learn a language, you have to learn it well and you have to be able to speak it well. So of course you still have to master English. You have to make sure that you're internationally intelligible, that you can hold your own anywhere in the world by speaking good English. But when you are in Malaysia or when you're in your own cultural context, you somehow want to slip into your own cultural being. For example, I won't ask you, Philip, after dessert, Philip, would you like to go out and have a cup of tea with me? You don't, right? I'll just say, Philip, want to have a drink? You know, you just sort of slip into your own comfortable self. And that's why we have got this very interesting, unique variety called Malaysian English, or Manglish for short. And in most countries, even in China, in Japan, you have got Japlish and Chinglish and so on. Yeah.
And Ramesh, do you think that's an issue, especially in the working professional environment where everybody has to converse in English, or English is still assumed that global language, right, that connects all these companies and businesses together? Do you think when everyone has their own kind of localized version of English that it's hard to bridge that gap, or do you think it's still okay?
No, I think we're managing pretty well. we have so many varieties, but I think the key term that Sukim used just now, that we are internationally intelligible. I think that's what we anchor our goals to for English language teaching. So we may have varieties, but we embrace them and we celebrate them. That we were colonized and that our education system was inherited from our colonial masters. That's our reality. But, you know, rather than push the narrative that promoting quality English language education is a rejection of a national language or of our mother tongue, I think instead of doing that, I think we need to come to terms with the fact that English is also part of the fabric of Malaysian society. Depending on where you find yourselves, if I would meet someone here in Malaysia, chances are I'd make use of the English language to connect.
Yeah.
So it is very much part of us. And also look, for example, at our literary landscape in Malaysia. Malaysian writers such as Lloyd Fernando, Shirley Lim in post-independent Malaysia, and contemporary writers such as Isu Kim, as well as Malachi and Vietnamani, who are doing an excellent job in keeping our literary landscape vibrant.
Yeah, so I agree with Dr. Ramesh. It is still very important to have the international intelligibility, because can you imagine if all of us, all the diplomats are seated at the United Nations, if they all spoke in their own varieties, there'll be no comprehension at all. So I think basically the varieties of English developed when there was a good command of English and your own variety, not bad English. Bad English isn't Malaysian English. People seem to think that, oh, Manglish is bad English. No. So we should not degenerate into a position where we just speak bad English and we think it's Manglish. Not at all. People who speak very good English continue to maintain that, but they're able to just slip and switch into Malaysian English.
That's, I think, the interesting thing, because you hear so many Puritans saying, oh, Manglish is destroying the language, right? I'm sure you hear many people criticize you, right, for the fact that, you know, you're trying to localize it, but they don't understand that actually language is always an evolving element, that perhaps we look at it from a dimension of our country, but technology is also evolving our language per se as we speak, right? Yeah. How do you respond to those Puritans then?
Well, I keep telling them that, when we speak a variety, it doesn't mean that we are turning our backs on the proper English. You know, it has just evolved because we are cultural beings. We are cultural selves. We don't say, oh, goodness gracious me, great balls of fire. My house is on fire. Something. You just say, ayo, ayya. You know, we slip into our alamak. We just slip into our own cultural selves. We're comfortable with expressing ourselves using all the sounds and the idioms and expressions of our own culture. And sometimes the even even have words or concepts in our culture that you don't have in English. And that's not unfathomable because English comes from, evolved from England. For example, I can think of just three words in our own cultures that do not have an equivalent in English. One would be tumis, you know, tumis the food, sauté is not even the correct word, but you just can't find in English. Another one would be garam. Oh, so garam, when you pinch his cheeks, yes. You can't find a word in English. Or another one would be wok hei. So when it comes to writing, I find it quite interesting. So when I want to try and describe something, I sometimes grapple with trying to find an English word. Mm. So it's wrong to just say that, you know, you can just express yourself in one mode when actually we are, you know, so multifaceted.
We are multimodal in that sense. And that's why I always am quite intrigued to understand whether or not we should need some institution or form to curate this or even put some structure and thought process to something like that. Like, do we need a Dewan Bahasa Pustaka equivalent for Manglish, right? Do we need an Oxford Dictionary equivalent of Manglish, right? Something that curates it, I guess, Ramesh and Sukim later.
So I think based on what Sukim said just now, we have to keep in mind, it's not just about us making use of language to fill the needs, our immediate needs, but we also want to keep in mind that English also absorbs a lot of borrowings from other languages.
Yes.
And you find that every year, new words are added to dictionaries. Mm-hmm. And that's part of this process of curating information and documenting it. So documenting, you know, the evolution of a language, it's important for several reasons. It helps with, establishing our cultural identity, preserving languages. So these are important processes. And evolving varieties such as Manglish, they also serve as a vehicle for creative expression, in literature, in music, in film. And so preserving it ensures that, creating avenues, creative avenues remain open.
And this is where I was reflecting that when we start claiming it as our own, actually then we don't need to have this conversation about either or, that it has to be Bahasa or English, right? We start embracing multilingualism, bilingualism, right? Why is it that many people in society feel that when I pick English or learn a language, I have to compromise another language? Why can't it be self-reinforcing then? Because if we're going to see things being adopted and that language is a permeable, movable object, right, that actually evolves with time, why is it that people still so struggle with the fact that it's an either-or situation when it comes to learning a language?
I also ponder over that because, in fact, Malaysia, we are in such a unique position. We are multicultural, we are multilingual, we are plurilingual. We are a country that has got, four civilizations, right? Nusantara Malay, we've got Chinese, we've got Indian, and we've got the Western civilization influences in this country. So we are in a very unique position and we should be cashing in on that, you know, really capitalizing on that. We've got people who are very fluent in English and in Mandarin who are like executives and in demand in the hospitality industry in Shanghai, in Macau. We've got people who can operate very well in India, in London, in Sydney. The brain drain, I mean, they just get PR in foreign countries. So I think we should be capitalizing on this. We have got so many languages. We shouldn't be frightened that, okay, if I master this language, then I'm a lesser Chinese or I'm lesser Malay. Not at all. I think we should be really going all out, being multilingual or plurilingual or bilingual and not be afraid of taking on these languages.
Mm. And Ramesh, you know, just want to get your perspectives, right? When you hear the case for it is so solid. You know, we started the conversation about witnessing the decline since the 1970s. If you were able to advise the government, right, what are the policies, what are the actions that you think we need to do as a government, as industry, to reverse the decline?
The narrative needs to change. Mm. There's no point, you know, as I said just now, telling children that English is necessary for a future which appears very distant to them. They need to be able to see languages coexist alongside each other, especially in the Malaysian context. Take, for example, English and our national language, Bahasa Melayu. So that has to be seen by children in school. Imagine, if you will, subjects such as history or science, where students are given the opportunity to learn through discovery by accessing information. More often than not, a lot of information is more readily available in English than it is in the Malay language because of the internet. I'd like to see a system where these subjects allow students to access knowledge regardless of the language in which they access it, you know, to draw on their skills in English as well as the Malay language and have these languages coexist within our education system. I think that would send, that would drive motivation for students to really master both languages and realize that we can't do without one. Yes, it's important to advance the national language, should not be at the expense of English.
I think one problem is that politicians should not interfere in the language policies. I think the trouble with what's happening now is that it is too politicized. Every time you get a new minister of education or a new ministry, or you know, they start bringing in new policies and changing things instead of riding on all the strengths, riding on very good English language development projects. When you have all these different political ideas and flip-flop decisions, that undermines the teaching of English in this country.
Well, thank you for all your inputs and perspectives today on this really crucial topic. On today's Breakfast Grill, I have the privilege of speaking to Associate Professor Dr. Ramesh Nair from MARA and also Dr. Lee Soo Kim, formerly from University Kebangsa, Malaysia, in conjunction with World English Language Day. This is The Breakfast Grill. I'm Philip C, BFM 89.9.
Business fueling minds. The Breakfast Grill with U-Mobile Biz, Malaysia's number one 5G network. 5G makes business sense.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.